Hello, welcome to the Second Society podcast. My name's Dave Schmidt, and my guest in conversation is Joe Atwill. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Dave. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing fine. So we had a interesting weekend and end of last week, apparently. Two things stuck out in my attention space. One was the placing on a no-fly list of sort of alt-right commentator and reporter named Nick Fuentes. And then the other item was the suspension by the hosting platform named Kartra of a conference, rather impressively peopled conference, called Truth Over Fear, and it was dedicated to the topic of COVID and the vaccines and the place that all of those things have in the larger global hegemony to capture the world society and economy. So what are your thoughts on those things, and let's see if we can hash that out a little bit.
Yeah, well, I thought the Fuentes things was very, very illustrative of the onset of basically a police state.
Yes.
He was not charged with anything, but he was restricted from travel just as, because he was in political opposition to, the political class. So he was a critic.
Right, and maybe I should interject here.
Yeah.
He was intending to travel to Florida, as I understand, to speak at a conference regarding technological tyranny. Is that how you understand it?
Yes, that's exactly how I understood it. And the fact that he was put on this no-fly list should be sort of a wake-up call to all Americans that there is, evil is afoot inside our nation, and we're not responding with enough pushback because as I was saying, there was no reason for his, the fact that he had been denied the capacity to travel, other than he was a political opponent of the power structure, and he was going to a conference where they were going to discuss the future in that regard. So this was just a way of political manipulation and control that had no process. There was no, in other words, it wasn't like he'd been convicted of anything. This was just, someone had put him on this no-fly zone, and there was no one there, no political process to defend him.
Right.
And so I thought this was really very chilling and very upsetting, that this can go on in our country. It seems like it's a complete denial of the First Amendment. And I was disappointed that no one really picked it up as a news story. This has just been 100% like covered by the independent media. And this is sort of showing to me the response, the lack of response, that really the independent media, that it shows like the ones we're trying to create here and now that are becoming the media. I mean, we are more and more every day becoming the only source, such as we are. I mean, not to say that we have resources or, get everything right, but there's nowhere else to turn, Dave. I mean, the mainstream media is just a tool of the oligarchs, and the oligarchs are manipulating our political system into a dictatorship.
Yes, and a technique that we're seeing, I've experienced it in my own life, Just recently, the parents, I believe it was in Arizona, who showed up at some sort of school board meeting to complain about, if I got it correctly, the mask mandate, were barred from entering, and the officials, and this is what I want to focus on, the officials called law enforcement and complained about the potential for violence as represented by these parents. Well, the sheriff shows up, and fortunately, thank God, the sheriff makes a public statement that these parents were in no way anything other than peaceful. They absolutely did not represent any kind of a violent threat. This is kind of a little sub-echo, too, of the claim that all those thousands of people in Washington, D.C. on January 6th represented a violent insurrection. I've seen this somewhere I saw it happening during the Obama administration when I was working in government. And I'm sure that the foundation of that, of course, was laid during the Bush administration post 9/11, rather quickly post 9/11. And, back in those days, I didn't see a problem with the Patriot Act or whatever they called it. And boy, was I naive. These kind of dictators and fascists, they recognize that merely with those tools in place, all they need to do, they don't have to offer a credible a complaint or provide evidence whatsoever. They just merely need to say, I'm afraid that there's violence that these people are going to bring. And that brings down all the force of various levels of law enforcement against their opponents.
Yeah, I mean, it's sophistry to usher in a slave state, and the public, we really need to fight back with everything we have against this. The process that the Constitution describes, of like due process, of how you have to go through these steps in order to restrict the population, the citizens, from behavior, that process is absolutely sacrosanct. We have to defend it with everything we have, because if you give it up, like we did, with the Patriot Act and with all these emergency powers and with the current medical emergency actions, they're doing, including the vaccine, which I'm sure we'll talk about, then you've just permitted a dictatorship to be set up and to have very clever ways of restraining you from fighting against it.
Yes. I had a discussion with a good fellow this morning, farmer, and at a coffee shop. And, I mentioned the new USDA rules that have been imposed with the under this current regime that we have in Washington. And specifically, these are the USDA rules that rather lopsidedly will give money to minorities, minority farmers, and specifically deny white farmers assistance. And I was interested because since this fellow's a farmer, I was hoping he would give me more information about it. What he did tell me was that basically the government is paying off the loans of black and minority farmers to the exclusion of white farmers. And, you know, but here's what's interesting. A good fellow. I like this fellow. But he actually got angry with me. He got angry with me for bringing it up. He said the only way this can be fixed is by sending people to the state capitol and Washington. Other than that, my beating the drums isn't going to do anything. But, you know, I appreciated his comments, but it's very typical. And I've been a political activist for quite some years. We've talked about that before when I was in California and then here. And so I do understand, and I've been, again, we've succeeded on a couple of these things. And so I understand a little bit about the organization that's necessary, political and then, you know, just lobbying and how it gets done and all the steps in between that involve motivating people. And it's interesting, Joe, how people will shoot themselves in the foot even before they've begun with very what amount to essentially defeatist psych-outs that they do on themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this many, many times. And it has to do, I think, with a kind of fatigue that white Americans, European Americans have, that no matter what we do politically, the country just seems to always take turns against us. You know, I mean, you know, look, for example, at affirmative action. This is something which is, you know, one would think is just unconstitutional on its face. It's had an enormous and destructive effect upon white businesses, on the capacity to even for like association with people that you want. I mean, it's just, it's really been this disaster. And, you know, there have been many attempts to try to make it more rational, but they always fail. And my point here is just that the problem that I think white Americans have is that they don't understand that the system is rigged in and of itself. In other words, that the people who you see as, you know, as potential candidates, like Trump or Hillary Clinton, that these people have all been selected in advance. So if you want to fix this system, you have to go a little bit deeper into it. You have to start fixing, you know, the grassroots aspect of it. And so this is, I would say to this friend of yours is, you know, yes, the system as it exists will not give you anything. And the only way you can reach that point where you're getting some representation is you have to go deep into go local. Start with local areas because there you can actually have some effect. The political class controls the president, the governor, I mean, all of the large, you know, up ballot, political, contests are going to be controlled by the oligarchs. But down ballot, you have a shot. And this is where you should be focusing your energy, is to create a culture, political culture around you, your mayor, your sheriff, your councilman, the school board. These things should be an iron rock of democratic protection. So this is the first thing, is that the public needs to stop paying attention to the puppet show, which is controlled by the oligarchs of the presidency, the Senate, the governor, large city mayors. I mean, look at how Soros created an absolute like a Potemkin village. I mean, he put in DAs that are in direct opposition to Europeans almost in every major city in the United States. And these are people who are literally going to stand the police down when there is dangerous rioting. So this is the level of control that the oligarch class has at that level, the big items in on your ballot. But that doesn't mean you quit fighting. It just means you have to fight all the harder for the offices which you can have some input in.
Right. You know, there is this phenomenon among white Europeans, which doesn't necessarily work in their favor. And sometimes we have to be willing to face those things that are impeding us, both those things that are part of our nature. And Kevin MacDonald has explored this, the sort of genetic roots of some of our the Northwest European behaviors and characteristics in particular. But also then, as you mentioned, the nurture things, the ways in which people once burned, twice shy, have learned to become give in to their frustration regarding politics. And it's very clever the way the opposition does this. They frustrate people at the high level or the national level, and then people say, well, okay, let's go back local. And then they try to do things locally, and it does take a lot of work. And there's something I think about white Europeans, which they're not well disposed towards long political battles. White Europeans seem to be very, and maybe this is why they're good at business and things like this. They assess things like a businessman on a very short term schedule, and it's very rational. However, if it's not going to show a profit in the first half or the first quarter, or if some political enterprise doesn't have promise to overturn the whole mess in let's say less than a year, then they give up on it. And you know, one thing we have to give to our opponents is they are in this for the long haul, because frankly, many of them don't have lots of talents. They don't have other businesses or professional academic aspirations. They're just in it as a group collective. And so what other choice do they have than to be in it for the long haul? But I think that we need to learn how to do things for the long haul and not to always demand success from every initiative. Some initiatives that we take they're highly likely to fail in their simply stated goals. But what our opponents realize is that they win moral victories even when they lose the practical battle. And we have to learn some of those skills.
Right. Well, I think the one thing that we need to understand is the success of an attack against Europeans that was easily to see through what's called the authoritarian personality.
Yes.
This was a pseudoscience paper which takes the position that Europeans are neurotic in general, and that creates a scale for personality aspects which would just be normal and wholesome under most any real definition, but somehow the American Jewish Committee was able to create this document, which then became so influential.
Personality
became so influential.
Right? And you mean to say that it's a false diagnosis of neuroticism?
It's an absolutely false diagnosis of right. neurosis, right? And so this is what they did is they created the idea that if you have a tendency to want to have authority, which of course is necessary in every family for a father, if you have ethnocentric, you're proud of your and think your relationship to your ethnicity is valuable. I mean, these things were given the impression was created that this is neurosis and also just outright evil, because remember, this was done following the World War II, and they were claiming they were trying to prevent another Holocaust. You know, this was sort of the justification. So it created a moment in time when it was very hard for Europeans to say, well, wait a second. I like my ethnicity. I want to retain my pride in it. And I'm not interested in having, you define it, my pride in my ethnicity and my desire as a father to have authority. I don't want people to try to define these things as evil. I think you're evil for trying to do this.
Right.
But it didn't happen. The authoritarian personality became just sort of the basis for what we can see now in cultural Marxism, which becomes, the woke consciousness, different terms for it, but it's all really the same thing. And so to me, this is the critical area of expertise that, Europeans have to develop, is an understanding of the techniques that have led to the culture we're living in.
Right. One little, I think, phalanx in this battle, the line that we could develop is, much as Sigmund Freud constructed or was largely involved in constructing this false diagnosis, this false branch of psychiatry, I think our side, for instance, psychologists, psychiatrists, what have you, need to step up to the plate and start writing on this topic. Philosophers are another group. They need to start writing in a way that is ethno-confident. And certainly I would like to see that as a European confidence. But, in truth, I want to see every ethnic group be confident about itself. I mean, and to deal with its weaknesses and to move forward on its strengths. My particular perspective is that borders are the way in which we protect ethnic diversity, and that borders are an effective channel of communication. They're actually a communication enhancing device between different ethnic cultures. And that this is what people reject. They reject that there is such a thing as a culture that is a manifestation of people's biology. And as a biologist, particularly a behavioral biologist, I'm particularly tuned to seeing how this works. But many people, especially since the time of, the pseudo-anthropologist Boas, have been taught to ignore racial, ethnic, and cultural differences. They think that this is, you know, just a matter of switching from some type of mashed corn to eating McDonald's. That's all it is. And, you know, and it's part of that the attempts of the oligarchs to design us, to recreate us into the mold of nothing more than consumers.
Yeah, I would, to me, I would start out when you, for example, you talked about Freud. What I would like to see is an analysis of Freud as a sophist.
Yeah.
As in other words, what he was really trying to do was to end the modesty and monogamy that is needed for the family, which is a critical part of ethnic strength. So when you see, you know, the idea that you're neurotic, you have mental problems because you're not allowing your sexuality to have its normal flow, which would take you into affairs and to a more pornographic lifestyle. Okay, so I think Freud is really best looked at as a cultural weapon that was cleverly designed to break up the substance, the structure of ethnicity, which requires you know, monogamy as its central kind of unifying piece. And when you look at Freud in the context of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture, which we can now see very clearly was an artificial construction designed to weaken ethnic culture, right? Because it's so much of it has been exposed as coming through MK Ultra, which incidentally was very much related, or comes from the Macy Conference, kind of the precursor of MK Ultra, which is plugged right into the American Jewish Committee's authoritarian personality. So it's really, even though they may seem like separate things, it's actually all leading to one place. You have a more sexualized, less family structured, less ethnic conscious group, which then becomes the white middle class, which of course is then, you know, from there you can go straight into pornography, the single mom, and to the world we have now. So this is long-winded, Dave, but I'm just saying is that to me there's been a trajectory of, for whatever reason, attacks against the substance of European ethnic structure. And now if we want to have a world where we have the kind of power and dignity that you were kind of referring to in your earlier comment, I think we've got to look at, well, how did we get debased? And then from that, we're using that information, we can draw a plan up as to how we can you know, reverse this, and how we can you know, take our culture back, because it's been stolen from us.
Right. I had a discussion, a podcast discussion with Tim Kelly, and I was describing how when I was a graduate student at Notre Dame, one evening I went to the library and I just grabbed one of the photo journals off of the shelf in the periodical section. And here it was devoted to Nelson Rockefeller. And it's describing him as a Christian evangelist traveling in South America. I mean, my head's spinning. I mean, I never thought of him as being a religious zealot, you know. Well, here what it was it also then, it mentioned in the article that he was also promoting contraception and also was trying to develop Protestant a Protestant competition to the Catholic Church in South America. And then, of course, it was all tied in with the contraception. Well, all of a sudden, everything fit together in my mind. Because I had wondered, gee, how does Father Hisberg get to be a board member of Chase Manhattan Bank? That seems like, he doesn't seem like a banker to me, but, maybe more than I thought. Notre Dame was essentially rewarded with lots of privileges, and basically what Father Hisberg signed over to the Rockefeller Empire was the American Catholics' reproductive potential, and this was reinforced by a very, very real experience I had as a teaching assistant in the biology department. And we would have these weekly meetings with one of the faculty members who was the organizer of the teaching assistants. And we'd go over the upcoming laboratories and that would have. And so we get to this section in the textbook, and all these biology textbooks had an enormous, overly long section as an insert, really, a misplaced insert where you almost feel like it's a pharmaceutical advertisement, for contraception. So anyway, I kind of protest. I said, well, I'll go over this stuff with the students as long as I can. You'll permit me to add my spin on a Catholic perspective about it, and maybe even mention in more correct light how natural family planning can work, etc. But she said, "Oh, sure, that's okay." She said, "But I want to tell you all." So we're all assembled there. She's not talking just to me, but to all the teaching assistants. And she says, "I'll tell you a little story." She said, "Many years ago, Father Hisberg would come in and he would take a whole class out of the biology class, introductory biology class semester. He would spend the whole class teaching the students how to use contraceptive devices." And I'm thinking, you're kidding me. The president of the university comes into a biology class, president of a Catholic university, and he teaches them how to use contraception. Well, I mean, this solidified my initial suspicions, about how this was all working. And so that's part of the capture that occurred. And so by pulling that little block out of the edifice in American culture, specifically the Catholic culture in America, this is also how these Rockefeller interests managed to further capture all of the United States for in this way, reproductively subdue European white culture in America.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that the kind of reality of Hisberg has never been understood. I mean, in my opinion, he would be what's called a lifetime actor. I know that this can be contested, and if I was asked to prove this, I could only do it analytically. I wouldn't have, the documents. But in my opinion, Hisberg is part of what was done to destroy European culture, which is to say that individuals who are actually not real Europeans, or if they were simply under complete financial or somehow psychological control, were put into positions of power deliberately just for the purpose of making sure that the process of cultural Marxism succeeded, okay, which is all of the things which are now in power politically and culturally, which have all been destructive to European ethnic consciousness and European reproduction, were at first given the position of being morally equivalent of traditional Catholic or traditional European cultures. Then they were given the position of, well, they're morally superior to them, and now they're in the position of being legally mandated.
Yeah. Right?
So this is the process that we have gone through. It's an incremental process facilitated by they're putting into power people like Hesburgh, who would then make sure that the cultural Marxist agenda would succeed and be promoted, and that people who would stand up against it would be intimidated. You see, they have put into play this culture of intimidation where if you stand against it, and particularly if you say something like, well, I don't trust, I'll just give an example. You go, well, I don't trust Freud. He's Jewish. He's a very partisan Jewish person. He may have an ulterior motive for what he is claiming is a scientific conclusion. He might have a motive of actually trying to weaken European culture to the benefit of Jewish culture, right? If you have that as a position, which I think is completely not just legitimate analytically, but in fact, evidentially real, then the intimidation, the charges of anti-Semitism, that you'd never get out of there unless you were prepared, you know, for a real battle. And this is what they've done step by step, is they've made people who would want to make this argument, who would want to go, you know, This is not quite adding up. I think we have to look at it not just as an attempt at kind of a new sort of understanding of the human psychology, but maybe this is actually a weapon. Maybe actually the Freudian, you know, what I would call pseudoscience, isn't just bad thinking on Sigmund's part, but it's actually designed to create a platform in which pornography is less likely to be criticized, right? Because it has this pseudo-psychological, you know, it's helping us recover our real self, do our own thing, not be neurotic. It's healthiness. It's health. It isn't. So this is what happens, you know, when you start having these lifetime actor types come in. They don't just, like with Hesburgh, they don't just, you know, facilitate kind of this new sort of understanding of culture. But Dave, they also create a culture of intimidation where now you can't talk about these things. You can't ask honest questions about, could this be like a kind of racial attack? You see what I mean? So it's a two-pronged thing. They get the authority. They do this and, you know, by various long-term methods, the kind of thing you were talking about. And then once they have that, they then start using the psychological techniques to make people afraid to criticize this on the grounds that they'll be accused of being anti-Semitic if they question whether or not this is even legitimate science that you're dealing with, but in fact is a kind of clever racial attack.
Right. And they very cleverly use two principles from animal behavior, ethology, which is mobbing. Mobbing exists in the animal world. You particularly see it when a small weak species will gather in numbers to drive off a single individual of a larger, more powerful species. Let's say the way small birds will mob a crow, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And organizations, HR departments, I truly believe, and I've been writing on this, and hopefully I'll come out with a book on this, are developing organizational mobbing as a way of circumventing due process. So they can enhance natural tendency of people in groups to mob individuals that managers will signal as being a threat to the group. The other thing I think that they understand is the way that people, and it varies according to culture again, but it's probably existent in all cultures, even in European independent, northwestern European independent cultures, is that people really submit to authorities. Most people will submit to a leader. I know I've seen in different organizations how oftentimes the leader is a very tall and imposing individual. So oftentimes it helps if they have a good deep voice, you know. And they will defend those leaders against all criticisms. So this is kind of a problem that we have, is that we abdicate our role in society as citizens in order to demonstrate fealty to a leader. Now, I say that even though I really do believe there also, you know, intention with this is our need to recognize natural hierarchies. You mentioned earlier, you know, fathers and families, etc. And so there are natural hierarchies. So the egalitarian and the hierarchical have, I think, a proper tension between them, the egalitarian leading to the kind of well-educated citizen who can participate in debate and conversation, and the hierarchical, which recognizes that some individuals have talent. And, of course, we're talking mostly about intellect. When you're talking about it on a natural scale, going back to Alexander or Caesar, you probably also need to recognize that in those times lots of warfare, hand-to-hand warfare, that they were also imposing militarily able, fit warrior types, as well as being intelligent. These are natural tendencies. We need to recognize them, and we need to develop appropriate ways of both channeling and those things, checking those things, and where appropriate, acknowledging and even respecting those things.
Let me give you an example to underline your point, which I think is really a good one. Look at how the kind of medical scientists have gotten the public to accept the gene therapy, first of all, as a vaccine, which is, you know, just crazy. But they people are taking it with the idea that they can trust, you know, people like Fauci, the various talking heads that they brought forward, and they don't do an independent review of it as something that could be potentially dangerous. They just rely on their belief in the benevolence of the experts that, you know, are talking at them with, you know, with all of, you know, the authority of so-called science.
Yes, it's, it is interesting. Underlying their deference to these individuals is an implicit statement that these individuals are trained, they're intelligent, there's a reason why they are our leaders, even if it's something like the CDC and Fauci, this kind of a newer phenomenon that these are able to rise up to such esteem. Speaking as a scientist, I like it, the idea that scientists are afforded some respect. Unfortunately, the public has gotten it wrong in this case. And so it's not, people always want some simple identifier of who they can trust, like a letter on a sports jacket or some kind of fancy hat or, accreditation that comes from, you know, having a sportscaster stick a microphone in front of your mouth. People always want an easy, quick way to assess who do I follow. You know, it's not that easy. It really does take some effort, and nobody should ever be afforded either carte blanche power or unlimited tenure as a leader. So we need to up our intellectual skills, I think, as a nation. Intellectual skills that can be critical, that can engage in conversation, that actually welcome it, that we don't become frightened by conversation.
The good old Socratic method.
Yeah. And look at where it got him.
Yeah.
So it's a long-standing problem.
If we don't develop it, I think we're really in tragic times. This is my opinion, Dave. I don't think that there's any rational basis for the demanding that the public take the gene therapy, which is being sold as a vaccine. Right. So since that is the case, there must be a malevolent explanation. That's my opinion. And therefore we are in really dangerous times because, you know, the public has given their power, their agency, to these medical individuals who I think are evil. And I think have genocide in mind. I think this is a real possibility here. And so we really want the kind of skeptical, you know, approach to culture, to thinking in general, to be very quickly adopted, because otherwise we're risking going out of existence.
Well, you know, I think I'm beginning to see a little bit of success. And people are learning also to make the distinction between the mRNA and DNA-based pharmaceuticals, such as they are, versus the traditional vaccines.
Yes.
They are opting for the traditional vaccines. They're starting to get it. That these mRNA and DNA devices, instruments, if you will, are only incidentally at this time being used as vaccines. The real purpose is, as we've discussed before, is to use them as platforms for introducing other genetic changes. And a couple of weeks ago, you and I looked at a paper by Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G, and I will plan to put that in the show notes for this podcast so people can look it up. Please look it up. And, you know, the Zhang paper does is using very credible sources speaking as scientists from very prestigious institutions, they're saying, yes, in fact, there are mechanisms whereby information from mRNA can flow into the permanent genetic code of the individual. And this should not be shocking. When I started learning about, I started college in a time when we were starting to see the big genetic advances in molecular biology. And from the very beginning, the talk was all about altering gene sequences. And it's been done on a vast scale in plants and animals. So this is not beyond the realm of possibility as these pseudo vaccine hawkers are trying to convince us now. Oh gosh, you know that. Well, I mean, that's theoretically possible, but I mean, no, the whole industry is built around genetic modification, for God's sakes. So, and you know, you and I, just to pat ourselves on the back, last fall, we were saying, you know, this is one of the real serious problems with the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine, where that they were that they had the potential of altering our DNA, and it was not well received. But I think people are getting it now that's a problem.
Yeah, and what's important about the Zhang paper, to me anyway, excuse me, is that it shows there's something dishonest in how the information about the vaccine is being presented to us. Because, okay, it is not established that the synthetic RNA will go in there and, you know, reverse transcribe and become a permanent change in your DNA. That hasn't been proven, and Zhang wasn't saying that in the paper. But what is the case is that it could happen, and that the people who have been telling us that it would never happen were completely incorrect. They knew perfectly well it was possible.
And in fact, in nature, it does happen.
Right.
Another form of the RNA, yes.
Yeah, so anyway, so therefore, since they definitely had this wrong, this should just raise the red flag once again. We can't trust them. You cannot trust these individuals. They may have ulterior reasons for these claims. Here's an example where they've made a claim and it's been proven to be incorrect, and they would have known. And it's something that one of the individuals who was talking about it was saying is that they certainly would have known that that this was possible. This is something like you were just saying. The whole industry is based around this possibility. It's not something that's unique or to this particular situation with the new genetically modifying vaccines they're trying to give us. Anyway, so it's just another red flag. It's another example where we have to think more critically. I'm very worried, and I was wondering what your opinion is of the possibility that we're really dealing with, you know, what Dr. Yerdon, who was the former chief medical officer of Pfizer, is concerned about, that we're dealing with a basically a bioweapon whose purpose is to radically reduce human population. Do you have a position on that, Dave?
Well, yes. In concert with what you're saying regarding the Zhang paper, is that when it's kind of like the way a detective thinks, you know, you have expectations. And then let's say you're interrogating a suspect and they lie to you, or even if they tell the truth about something, but they tell the truth in a way that is unnecessary or deviates from a certain kind of baseline, where you say, why would they be trying to draw my attention to that idea, albeit maybe a true one, when we could be talking about something else? And so the fact that they have deliberately poo-pooed the possibility of genetic harm is itself, that should raise a red flag and cause bells to go off. And there's never a good reason for lying. There's no, yeah. You know, and so that automatically should generate a whole line of questioning from both the public and from scientific and medical sources. And, you know, and then that's bringing up another problem, which is, especially in the last couple decades, it has roots much longer than that, of course. But in terms of seeing it manifested, the medical and the scientific communities have been almost completely captured. And it really is like a military capture. And those people, as long as they're getting a paycheck and not wanting to lose their retirement investments, they know that they better keep their mouth shut about this. And unfortunately, they are supposed to be our protectors. So the academy and governmental agencies like the CDC and the NIH and the National Science Foundation, for that matter, although it's smaller, these kind of organizations have just utterly failed in their most sacred duty.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Dave, we've been talking for about an hour. In closing, do you have some points that we didn't get a chance to cover you'd like to talk about?
Well, I guess I'd just like to conclude with this thought, and I'll welcome your thoughts too. We really need to organize. We keep saying this, and it goes back to what we were saying about the European disease. There are some problems with the European psychology, which is that we really make it very difficult for our own people to try and organize us. And we are, you know, it's funny, we talk about conspiracy theories as being kind of a delusional, unhinged, unmoored suspiciousness, when in fact there is delusional, unmoored suspiciousness, and that, but it has to do not with the asking of very appropriate questions in non-paranoid ways, but rather it has to do with our suspiciousness regarding attempts to have conversations and to organize at the grassroots level.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That is the biggest problem we're facing today. And if I can just, you know, pass along my thoughts to anyone listening to this, if you're not out trying to organize, you are not taking good advantage of this precious time. You know, it's very possible that we're going to be placed into a kind of slave state very quickly here. And they certainly seem to be trying to create such a thing. If, for example, the response to the virus was deliberately overreactive, then this is, you know, evidence that that's where we're headed. So this time is precious. And I just wanted to underline what Dave said, that, you know, we need to get out of our comfort zone. And the key here is to organize. Every political structure, like Catholic groups, you know, 4-H clubs, I don't care what it is, they should all, if you're in such a group and you're makes what we've been talking about is making sense, you should be going to that group and asking that there be a general discussion on this subject, on, you know, is this the situation we're facing, is it legitimate, or is this really just a clever way to create a slave state? And beyond that, are these things, these restrictions on religion, on assembly, on speech, on travel, as we talked about with Nick Fuentes, are these things that we really can accept, or should we start fighting against these restrictions?
Right. And if I could squeeze one more thing in, I was once told by somebody who was having a good, he was relaying a discussion he had with somebody of influence. And the person said, you know, one of the largest reservoirs of money in this country, of course, we're talking about other than the giant oligarchs. One of the largest reservoirs of sort of mid-range wealth in this country are Catholics and Catholic businessmen, etc. And, you know, I can, I mean, it's always been my impression that many businessmen, they're very good at collecting money, but they're very bad at making judgments about how to deal with their philanthropy. And they buy a lot of junk, and they think that they're making some kind of donation to society, and they buy junk for their parishes, you know, that they it's sort of these cosmetic things, you know. Without telling them, I'm not going to dictate what they should do, but I just ask that if there are any of them listening, sit down and have a good talk with yourself about where you put your money and what you can really do to affect some changes. And there's a kind of cheapness that people who have money infects their minds, and so that they want to give these things where they can get their name on it, or when they drive by they can always see that that gate that they bought for the church, the ironwork or something around the lawn, and that gives them comfort that their money wasn't thrown down the drain. But I contend that it is being thrown down the drain, that really we're in a battle, and the place for their money is like our opposition recognizes, is you put it in the hands of people and organizations that can really make fundamental differences. And how do you know what those organizations are? Well, if it makes you uncomfortable to think about them, that's probably the organization.
You know, well said. I couldn't agree more. And I would just actually go beyond that and say, if you're a European, and it's a broader, yeah, you know, idea, but if you are a European and you have wealth, and it is not being applied right now to trying to support the people who are resisting the onset of the slave state, then you are just really wasting valuable resources that are desperately needed other places. So for heaven's sakes, listen to what Dave just said, think about it, and try to find a way to, if you have a fortune, and it isn't something you don't, there's money that you aren't going to need to survive, this is the time it should be spent to try to protect us, because we are in real danger, in my opinion, at this moment. And, having a nice wall on a church isn't going to mean much if your entire family has been wiped out.
Yeah. Good, excellent point. After all, churches don't need walls.
That's right. Anyway, thank you so much for this discussion, Dave. Hope we can do it again soon.
Real pleasure. You take care, Joe.
Good luck. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.